Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, March 14th, 2024. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the United States, calls for new elections in Israel, saying that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take precedence over the best interests of Israel, and that he's too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza in the war between Israel and Hamas. Reports that the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, may be used to process migrants from Haiti if there is a large increase in refugees fleeing the gang violence in that country. We'll get White House reaction. And we'll talk to Washington Post Haitian reporter Widlor Merencourt in Haiti about the security and political situation on the ground and that agreement to create a new government after the resignation of the prime minister. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris visits a Planned Parenthood health center in Minnesota, highlighting the issue of reproductive rights in the Biden-Harris re-election campaign. And this is believed to be the first time a vice president or president has gone to a clinic that performs abortions. House Republicans continue their issues conference or retreat in West Virginia. Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra testifies before the Senate Finance Committee on the president's fiscal year 2025 budget request. Senate Labor Committee holds a hearing on a proposed 32-hour work week. And Congressman Bill Foster, a physicist, celebrates National Pi Day. From NBC News, in the most significant criticism by a U.S. leader against the Israeli government since its war with Hamas began, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Thursday called for new elections in Israel to replace Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the U.S. ever, said in remarks on the Senate floor that the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. Senator Schumer's remarks were part of a larger speech on the Senate floor in which he said the only realistic and sustainable solution for the endless wars between Israelis and Palestinians is a two-state solution, and that there are four obstacles to that goal. He said, number one, Hamas and the Palestinians who support the terror group. Number two, in his words, radical right-wing Israelis. Number three, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And number four, the Israeli Prime Minister.
The fourth major obstacle to peace is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has all too frequently bowed to the demands of extremists like Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and the settlers in the West Bank. I have known Prime Minister Netanyahu for a very long time. While we have vehemently disagreed on many occasions, I will always respect his extraordinary bravery for Israel on the battlefield as a younger man. I believe in his heart he has his highest priority is the security of Israel. However, I also believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel. He has put himself in coalition with far-right extremists like Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah. Prime Minister Netanyahu has also weakened Israel's political and moral fabric through his attempts to co-opt the judiciary. And he has shown zero interest in doing the courageous and visionary work required to pave the way for peace even before this present conflict. As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. Nobody expects Prime Minister Netanyahu to do the things that must be done to break the cycle of violence, to preserve Israel's credibility on the world stage, and to work towards a two-state solution. If he were to disavow Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and kick them out of his governing coalition, that would be a real meaningful step forward. But regrettably, there's no reason to believe Prime Minister Netanyahu would do that. He won't disavow Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gvir in their calls for Israelis to drive Palestinians out of Gaza and the West Bank. He won't commit to a military operation in Rafah that prioritizes protecting civilian life. He won't engage responsibly in discussions about a day-after plan for Gaza and a longer-term pathway to peace.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor today. The Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid posting on X that Senator Schumer's comments are proof that the prime minister is losing Israel's biggest supporters in the U.S. And he writes, what's worse, he's doing it on purpose. Netanyahu is causing heavy damage to the national effort to win the war and maintain Israel's security. Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Michael Herzog posting on X, Israel is a sovereign democracy. It is unhelpful. All the more so as Israel is at war against the genocidal terror organization Hamas, to comment on the domestic political scene of a democratic ally. It is counterproductive to our common goals. The U.S. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, followed Senator Schumer and took issue with the criticism of the Israeli Prime Minister.
The Jewish state of Israel deserves an ally that acts like one. People of Israel, at home and in captivity, deserve America's support. And Israel's unity government and security cabinet deserve the deference befitting a sovereign democratic country. The primary obstacles to peace in Israel's region are genocidal terrorists like Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, who slaughter innocent people and corrupt leaders of the Palestinian Authority, who have repeatedly rejected peace deals from multiple Israeli governments. And foreign observers who cannot keep these clear distinctions ought to refrain from weighing in. It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel. This is unprecedented. We should not treat fellow democracies this way at all. Things that upset left-wing activists are not a prime minister's policies. There is Israel's policies. Make no mistake, the Democratic Party doesn't have an anti-Bibi problem. It has an anti-Israel problem. Israel is not a colony of America whose leaders serve at the pleasure of the party in power in Washington. Only Israel's citizens should have a say in who runs their government. This is the very definition of democracy and sovereignty. Either we respect their decisions or we disrespect their democracy.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor. White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby was asked in an online audio briefing what the White House thought of Senator Schumer's comments about the Prime Minister of Israel.
Our next question will go to Nira with Israel Channel 13, Israel Channel 13.
Hey, thank you, Sam. Thank you, Admiral, for doing this. I was wondering, some aides may see Chuck Schumer's speech today as an intervention in Israeli domestic politics. What do you have to say about that?
I think we'll let people speak to them for themselves and how they want to see it. And as I said, Leader Schumer feels strongly, obviously strongly enough to make the comments that he did. I think we're going to let him speak to his thought process there. But again, our focus is on making sure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself, that everything's being done to avoid civilian casualties, that more aid gets in, that hostages get out. We're still having these conversations about a hostage deal. That's what we're focused on.
Thank you so much again for doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you. We'll next go to Nathan with Khan.
Thanks so much. Again, going back to the Schumer speech, just in general, does the administration have any policy regarding the need for elections in Israel? This relates also to the National Intelligence Assessment presented this week that spoke about Netanyahu's political viability. Is it the U.S.'s view that it is time for political change in Israel?
That's going to be up to the Israeli people. And the issue of elections is in the parliamentary process up to the Israeli government, a government elected by the Israeli people.
Would it be a wise move for Israel to move towards elections after the war is over?
That is up to the Israeli people.
Okay, thanks.
Questions to the White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby in an online audio-only news conference. Washington Post reports the Israeli military intends to direct a significant portion of Rafah's population of 1.4 million toward humanitarian islands in central Gaza. Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson Daniel Hagari said Thursday. Hagari said the humanitarian zones would be created with the international community to house the displaced and provide food, water, and other necessities. Israel also intends to flood Gaza with aid, Hagari said. His language hewed closely to that of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who told reporters on Wednesday, "We need to see flooding the zone when it comes to humanitarian assistance for Gaza." The announcement came ahead of Israel's planned ground offensive in Rafah. That from the Washington Post. Story from CNN, the Biden administration is discussing using Guantanamo Bay to process Haitian migrants if there is a mass exodus to the U.S. amid worsening conditions in the country, according to a U.S. official. For years, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which is located about 200 miles from Haiti, has had a migrant center to hold and process migrants before returning them to Haiti or a third country. But discussions to expand capacity at the site marked the latest sign of growing concern within the administration about people fleeing Haiti in droves as gangs attack government structures and social order is on the brink of collapse. That was from CNN. John Kirby, on that online briefing at the White House, took a question about this as well.
I know there's been some reporting that Haitian refugees might be processed through Guantanamo. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I've seen that. What I can tell you on that, Kelly, is that there's, and if you just give me a second, because I had a feeling this question might come up. There's a Department of Homeland Security task force called Task Force Southeast. And that task force continually watches and monitors migrant flow rates and all the different conditions under which migrants do flow in that particular part of the world down in the Caribbean. And particularly they watch closely maritime migration trends, people that are trying to flee to safety by boat. So we're always monitoring that. They adjust their assets to meet the challenges that come with the maritime migration. And in doing that, they're always looking at different options to try to address the challenges that the maritime migration might incur. So it's our policy to return non-citizens who do not have a fear of persecution or torture or legal basis to enter the United States. That won't change. Those that are interdicted at sea will be subject to immediate repatriation pursuant to, again, longstanding policy and procedure. There has been, in the past, one processing location for maritime migrants has been the naval station at Guantanamo Bay. It has been used in the past for that exact purpose for a repatriation processing. It is certainly remains an option to look at for again that eventuality, but I don't have anything firm. I don't have any concrete plans here to speak to. I think it's important for people to remember the context here, that the maritime migration remains a challenge in the Caribbean. We have to monitor it. We have to assess the flow. We have to do the proper repatriation processes and again, Guantanamo Bay has been used in the past for that. And so we'll certainly keep the options open as we continue to look at that. I would tell you, though, the last thing I'll say, and I promise I'll shut up, is that we're not seeing a heavy flow of Haitian migrants, certainly by sea, actually by any means right now. We're just not seeing a heavy flow of that. But because the situation is not getting better, because we know it's dangerous and unstable for the Haitian people, it would be irresponsible if DHS and the interagency wasn't taking a look at what we might do should that flow dramatically increase, and how we would properly handle individuals that might be seeking to flee.
John Kirby, White House National Security Communications Advisor, in an online audio news conference. Joining us now from Haiti is Widlor Merencourt, Haitian reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you for being with us. What is the political and security situation on the ground?
Well, on the ground, we have, as you said, two things going on mainly. The first is an insecurity problem. In the past weeks, gang leaders have waged, you know, a brutal attack against so many key institutions in the country. They attacked the airport, they attacked the two biggest prisons of the capital, releasing thousands of inmates in the streets. And even today, they are attacking businesses, including the house of the chief of the police, Mr. Francis. It is a very critical situation with Haitian National Police understaffed, under-equipped, and, you know, which lacks strategy currently to deal with the insecurity problem. That's the first part. The second part is we also have a political process that is ongoing. Negotiations are unfolding between the Caribbean community and several other stakeholders, including the U.S., Haitian politicians, civil society. And the goal and the framework that seems to be emerging is a new government that would have as a leader, a presidential council that is going to select prime minister, a new prime minister, to replace Ariel Henry, who resigned recently, and form a new cabinet.
What has been the assessment of how the U.S. and the Biden administration has been involved? The officials here say that this crisis should and will be resolved by the people of Haiti. Is that how it's being viewed there?
Well, since the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, Ariel Henry quickly became the prime minister. However, his name emerged also in the assassination of the former leader. And on the ground, he suffered, you know, a lack of legitimacy, and people took to the streets to protest his leadership for multiple times. And they go by the streets, maybe thousands. And a huge swath of the political actors here, you know, do not want to deal with Ariel Henry as a leader, right? So he was in power because the international community supported him. He was fighting at the time, you know, of the assassination with Claude Joseph, who was the prime minister. He did not have a cabinet, so Claude Joseph wanted to go, you know, all the way till the next elections, but the U.S. and a couple of embassies in Haiti put out a press release to urge Ariel Henry to form his cabinet. And it is in this context that Claude Joseph resigned and give back power to him. So this key support, you know, continued despite the fact that, you know, inside of the country he was, severely contested. Now that we reach this point where, you know, the distrust amongst the population and amongst many stakeholders here is such that it's making it difficult for him to continue to be governed. But not just that, the fact also that, you know, under his leadership, country became in a much more precarious security situation. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of people displaced by gang violence. We are talking about, you know, key institutions like the ports, like the airport, like the two prisons that were left up and releasing some of the worst criminals in the streets. You know, all these things, you know, make or contributed to the U.S. and CARICOM, the Caribbean community, to change policy and urge Ariana Lee to step down. But this new process that is being played out is not perfect. I talked to several politicians who criticized the fact that, some of the most important meetings where the future of the country is being discussed are not being conducted inside of Haiti, which is extremely difficult to do because gangs do not permit, the airport commercial flights to come in and out of the airport today, right? But some of these meetings actually do not have Haitian representatives. So we have a process where in so many protests you see in the streets people raising flags of foreign countries. People are asking the U.S. to take responsibility with regard to the political situation, but not just that. People are asking also the U.S. to help with the gun trafficking business. According to report from the Minister of Justice, many of the gangs, the vast majority of the guns that are being seized in crimes in Haiti can be traced back to the U.S. And these are like reports that ATF put out. And this flow of guns coming from the U.S. is a huge part of the story when it comes to why the gangs today in Haiti are so violent and vicious.
And a final question. There have been some questions about Americans in Haiti and their safety and what the U.S. ought to do. How many Americans are in Haiti, and are they sheltering?
Well, I don't have an official tally of Americans in Haiti. We do know, however, that many Americans live in Haiti, work in Haiti. The U.S. has an embassy here. It's a big embassy. We also know that in the last week, the U.S. helped airlift some of its personnel out of the country.
Washington Post Haiti reporter Wiglore Merencourt joining us from Haiti. This is Washington Today. Congressman Corey Mills, Republican of Florida, posting on X that he worked with a group of veterans to evacuate and rescue, he says, 10 U.S. citizens from an orphanage in Port-au-Prince. He writes, "This recent mission reiterates a disturbing reality that under President Joe Biden's leadership, American lives are continually jeopardized. I have conducted rescue evacs of Americans multiple times when Joe Biden has deserted them. There's a clear pattern of abandonment." And Congressman Mills goes on, "Americans at home and abroad are more unsafe under Biden than ever before. We need President Trump back in the White House as the world can't afford four more years of Biden's failed administration." The U.S. evacuated non-essential embassy staff from Haiti last weekend and also sent in an elite unit of Marines to help secure the U.S. embassy. In Washington, D.C. today, at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, asked General Laura Richardson, head of Southern Command, about plans for possible non-combatant evacuation operations, or NEOs.
General Richardson, yesterday we were talking a little bit about Haiti and the situation on the ground being chaotic, gangs running rampant in their capital. And this week, the Prime Minister of Haiti announced he would resign, and then Kenya paused the agreement to send 1,000 police officers until a new government would be put into place. Southcom has successfully airlifted embassy staff out of the country, but a number of Americans still remain in Haiti, and some may be looking to leave. Some are concerned that the U.S. has not initiated a non-combatant evacuation order, a NEO, to get Americans out of Haiti. General, have you been tasked to operate an evacuation?
So, Senator, as part of the wide range of contingency plans that U.S. Southcom has, we are ready for a activation if required, and have other plans ready to go, as we always do, and keep those plans refreshed over and over. So we're ready at any time for any type of crisis.
And are you doing, so you say you're ready now, but are there any additional preparations in the event that this becomes a necessity?
I think the two missions of increasing the security at the embassy and a little bit of my capability as well, expanding that, is the platform that we would use if we need to expand from there. And so we put in all of the necessary measures that are necessary for any of the plans to be activated.
So it would be true to say that there's mission planning currently underway in case you have to do this.
Senator, we always do mission planning in the military, so absolutely.
Well, thank you. Thank you, General.
Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat from Arizona, questioning General Laura Richardson, commander of U.S. Southern Command, at today's Armed Services Committee hearing. The Senate today confirmed a U.S. ambassador to Haiti, Dennis Hankins, filling a post that's been vacant since 2021. The vote was 89-1. The one no vote, Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana. Political rights, a 38-year U.S. Foreign Service veteran, Hankins has worked in Sudan and Congo and served as ambassador to Mali and Guinea. He is currently a foreign policy advisor in the National Guard Bureau at the Pentagon. Story from BBC News, Moscow has launched a wide-ranging campaign telling residents of occupied parts of Ukraine to vote in Russia's presidential election. For the first time, the national vote is taking place over 3 days, March 15th through 17th, but additional early voting has already begun in the occupied parts of four Ukrainian regions, Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, and Luhansk. One resident complained to pro-Russian collaborators with ballot boxes going house to house looking for voters accompanied by armed soldiers. Vladimir Putin will certainly win another term of office, but a high turnout would help the Kremlin's efforts to legitimize his continued rule. Would also be used to justify Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin is one of four candidates on the ballot, but none of the others poses a realistic challenge. All of his most outspoken critics have either been forced into exile, jailed, or have died. That was the reporting from BBC News. Reaction today from the U.S. State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller.
The United States condemns Russia's continuing efforts to undermine Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence through sham elections held in occupied Ukrainian territories. The United States does not and will never recognize the legitimacy or outcome of these sham elections held in sovereign Ukraine as part of Russia's presidential elections. To be clear, Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and Crimea are Ukraine. The results of these Potemkin-style exercises will be dictated by Moscow and cannot reflect the free will of the citizens of Ukraine who are being compelled to vote in them. This spectacle only further demonstrates Russia's blatant disregard for its obligations under international law. The United States will continue to use all available tools to hold accountable those individuals responsible for actions that undermine the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of free countries, including those who serve as election observers for the Kremlin's sham elections in occupied parts of Ukraine.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller at today's news conference in Washington. Story from CNN, Speaker Mike Johnson told Republican senators during their closed-door retreat Wednesday that he was committed to finding a path ahead for Ukraine aid in the House of Representatives, a sign GOP senators took to mean that aid to the embattled country isn't yet dead in Congress. But Johnson's message to senators also indicated the package he is looking at is unlikely to look like the $95 billion package the Senate passed. Republicans have been looking at using some kind of loan program, which wouldn't outright give equipment to Ukraine, but would be part of a kind of lend-lease program. That was from CNN. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach, so no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, which is free. Vice President Kamala Harris, writes the New York Times, met with abortion providers and staff members on Thursday in the Twin Cities, a visit that is believed to be the first stop by a president or vice president to an abortion clinic. The appearance at a health center was the latest leg in a nationwide tour by Ms. Harris, who has emerged as the most outspoken defender of abortion rights in the administration. While White House officials say they have largely reached the limits of their power to protect abortion rights, the issue has emerged as a linchpin of their reelection strategy. That was from the New York Times. The clinic was in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Many of you have asked, why am I here at this facility in particular? And I will tell you, it is because right now in our country, we are facing a very serious health crisis. And the crisis is affecting many, many people in our country, most of whom are, frankly, silently suffering. After the United States Supreme Court took a constitutional right that had been recognized from the people of America, from the women of America, in states around our country, extremists have proposed and passed laws that have denied women access to reproductive health care. And the stories abound. I have heard stories of and have met with women who had miscarriages in toilets, women who were being denied emergency care because the health care providers there at an emergency room were afraid that because of the laws in their state that they could be criminalized, sent to prison for providing health care. So I'm here at this health care clinic to uplift the work that is happening in Minnesota as an example of what true leadership looks like, which is to understand it is only right and fair that people have access to the health care they need, and that they have access to health care in an environment where they are treated with dignity and respect.
Vice President Kamala Harris at the Planned Parenthood Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's the fifth state she has visited since President Biden's State of the Union address, along with Arizona, Nevada, California, and Colorado. New York Times report on her visit has this: Minnesota has become a haven for abortion seekers since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ushering in restrictive laws and bans in neighboring states. The Society of Family Planning, a health research organization, found that the average number of abortions in the state increased by about 36% in the year after the Supreme Court decision. President Biden was in Michigan today meeting with voters on the front porch of a private home in Saginaw's Cathedral District neighborhood. It was part of a campaign organizing meeting. Associated Press reports that Saginaw County stands out as the sole Michigan county to have voted for the winning presidential candidate in the last four elections. President Biden was able to bring the county back to the Democratic column in 2020, but now faces apathy among black voters that could impact his success there and in other areas. The president's likely opponent on the Republican side, former President Donald Trump in this election year, this from Politico. Donald Trump is cleaning up comments he made last week in which he seemingly entertained the idea of cutting Social Security. In an interview with Breitbart News published on Thursday, Donald Trump insisted he would not touch the social insurance program, nor would he pursue cuts in Medicare. He told the site, "I will never do anything that will jeopardize or hurt Social Security or Medicare. We have to do it elsewhere, but we're not going to do anything to hurt them." The Health and Human Services Secretary, Javier Becerra, testified today before the U.S. Senate Finance Committee about President Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget request for his department. Senator John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, asked the secretary about undocumented immigrants.
What we've seen on the news, reported and written and on video and television, hospitals in sanctuary cities right now, New York City, Denver, San Diego, Chicago, Boston, tell us that they're at risk of collapsing financially due to the overwhelming number of illegal migrants flooding their emergency rooms and the clinics, who are essentially getting free care, having the American people pay for their care. Clinic in Chicago reported seeing nearly 16,000 migrants last year, illegal immigrants. The cost of their care totals over $30 million. This is what the hospital is reporting, paid for by American taxpayers. Denver Health was in the headlines in 2023, reported over 20,000 hospital visits from migrants. The hospital is now, not surprisingly, in financial distress. These hospitals are now asking the federal government to bail them out. And it's completely Democrat-caused failure to enforce the law at the southern border. Can you please explain why it is the responsibility of hardworking American taxpayers to foot the bill for all of this care for people, 9 million now, from all across the world who have flooded their way into the United States?
Senator, I appreciate the question. What I can tell you is that we have extended the resources and authorities that we have at HHS to try to be there to help any healthcare facility when there is a way that we can go in to be supportive. I don't know of a particular case that you might want to mention, but I know that we are prepared to be supportive of any facility where the authorities that you have given us allow us to go in and support.
Well, in terms of it's not hard to find stories about hospitals in one sanctuary city after another saying we are overwhelmed with the number of people that we're treating and have no way to recover the costs other than to turn to the American taxpayers. The federal government doesn't pay for the health care of every legal U.S. citizen. It seems like it's in the position now of having to do it for all these illegal immigrants. Why should the American citizens be forced to pay for illegal migrants to receive this same care for free? Because that's what's happening.
Senator, I don't know how particular states operate their healthcare systems with regard to the folks that are coming in, but what I can tell you is that when we are approached, whether it's through the Medicare program, the Medicaid program, or simply those who are seeking other types of authorities and funds that could help them, we're ready to try to be responsive.
You are aware that when a hospital is inundated with people who are not paying, they have to shift the cost to the people that are paying, and that's what's happening right now all across the country and specifically at so many of the sanctuary cities.
Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming, questioning the Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra at today's Finance Committee hearing, part of a series of Biden administration cabinet secretaries testifying at House and Senate committee hearings on the president's budget request for fiscal year 2025, which was released earlier this week. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, has introduced a bill to reduce the standard work week from 40 hours to 32 hours with no reduction in pay. It would be by lowering over 4 years the threshold for overtime pay for non-exempt employees. Senator Sanders chairs the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee and held a hearing on the bill today. One of the witnesses was Sean Fain, president of the United Auto Workers.
It's sad to say that in 1933, the U.S. Senate passed legislation to establish a 30-hour work week, but due to intense corporate opposition, that legislation failed. But in 1940, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act, establishing a 40-hour work week. 84 years ago, the 40-hour week was established. And since then, we've had a 400% increase in productivity, but nothing's changed. You know, that was why we had in our Big Three campaign, we had our stand-up strike. We raised the flag for a 32-hour work week. This isn't just a union issue, contrary to what some people want to talk about. This is a working class issue. And that's why 75% of Americans in our contract fight stood with us in that fight, because they're all living the same reality. You know, Who's going to act to fix this epidemic of lives dominated by work? Are the employers going to act? Will Congress act? You know, how can working class peoples take back their lives and take back their time? And I know what people and many in this room will say. They'll say, people just don't want to work, or working class people are lazy. But the truth is, working class people aren't lazy. They're fed up. They're fed up with being left behind and stripped of dignity as wealth inequality in this nation, this world, spirals out of control. They're fed up that in America, three families have as much wealth as the bottom 50% of citizens in this nation. That is criminal. America is better than this.
UAW President Sean Fain testifying before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Another witness, Liberty Vittard, data science professor at Washington University Business School, St. Louis, said a shortened work week would not result in the benefits claimed by the proponents.
The companies that choose to participate in some of these studies, like the 4-Day Week Global Study, are companies whose work tend to be able to be adapted to a shorter work week already, who can remove, quote, wasted hours. It is specifically only companies that are able to adapt to shorter work week that tend to participate, cutting out, as they say, extraneous meetings, coffee breaks, having more independent work, going to Zoom. However, over 70% of the U.S. job economy is people working with their hands. They don't necessarily have extraneous meetings or too many coffee breaks to cut out. So statistically, you can't apply this type of cutting of hours across the entire economy. Also, given the types of companies that are potentially capable of cutting their work week, we could see a divide of the rich getting richer, having more time, and the poor needing to take on three part-time jobs in order to pay the bills. We also potentially disadvantage older workers who cannot necessarily physically do the same amount of work in a shorter time. This happened to the great detriment of that population during the Great Depression. In terms of increased productivity, by shortening the week, the statistics just aren't there, and there are specific studies that show the opposite. Japan tried it, as Dr. Cassidy said, from 1988 to 1996, and the result was not ambiguous. Economic output fell by 20%. Another largely touted study was in Iceland, which had a pilot program cutting the work week by about 4 hours from 2015 to 2019. The results were blasted all over the headlines as this overwhelming success. What is not reported on is that the Icelandic government, or rather taxpayers, now have to shell out almost $30 million extra a year to hire more healthcare workers because of this experiment.
Liberty Vittard, data science professor at Washington University Business School, St. Louis, at today's Senate hearing on 32-hour workweek proposal put forth by the chair, Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont. You heard the witness refer to Dr. Cassidy. That's Bill Cassidy, the ranking Republican on the committee. He is from Louisiana. And in the House, Congressman Mark Takano, Democrat from California, has introduced a companion bill. Wall Street today, the Dow down 137, NASDAQ down 49, S&P down 14. CNBC writes the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell Thursday and snapped a three-day win streak after the release of hotter-than-expected U.S. inflation data sent Treasury yields higher. President Biden came out in opposition to the planned sale of U.S. steel to Nippon Steel, writes Associated Press, saying on Thursday that U.S. needs to maintain strong American steel companies powered by American steel workers. He added, U.S. Steel has been an iconic American steel company for more than a century, and it is vital for it to remain an American steel company that is domestically owned and operated. AP writes, by opposing the merger, President Biden has chosen to support unionized workers in a critical election year at the risk of upsetting the business community and an essential ally in Japan. On this National Pi Day, a message from Congressman Bill Foster, Democrat from Illinois, who has a Ph.D. in physics.
I rise today to celebrate March 14th, 314, or Pi Day, Pi is a Greek letter, and in mathematics, it's a symbol for the number that you get when you divide a circle's circumference by its diameter. Many people approximate pi as 3.14 or 3.14159265 and on, but the number is irrational. If you try to write down the exact number for pi, there are an infinite number of digits to the right of the decimal point, and there would be no discernible pattern. That means we're down to a mere infinity number of digits to be found, and there's so much new math to be discovered. And mathematics is critical to everything that we do. It's the language of science, the language of engineering and technology. So, amidst all of the irrationality that we see about us in Congress, let's celebrate a little of that irrationality on March 14th and celebrate Pi Day. Thank you, and I yield back.
Congressman Bill Foster, Democrat from Illinois, on the House floor. He is a physicist. Congressman Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, posted on X a photo of himself in front of his office writing, "Happy Pi Day. When I was first elected to Congress, I chose office 314 and kept the Pi office until renovations to the building necessitated relocation. Hashtag nerd pride, hashtag Pi Day." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.